Well, good evening, everybody. Warm welcome, one and all, to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. We're coming to you live on battery power from a field tonight in Glyndŵr-Fyrdwy, out in North Wales, where I'm at the Conscious Tribal Gathering. Now quite a field full of people. So we've got, I'm not quite sure how long the batteries are going to last. We'll see whether we make it to midnight or not, but hopefully there's going to be a whole variety of interesting people to listen to and talk to about just what it is that's going on here. And I'm joined first of all by Katie Crooney, who's been on the show before, and thanks very much for coming back, Katie.
Thanks for having me again, it's great to be back.
So I guess you've been continuing to investigate your shamanic works and community living and stuff since we last chatted. So perhaps it'd be good to talk about your investigations into community, first of all. What have you been doing?
So there's a few of us in the Wrexham County. We're in the process of finding suitable land, but we're working on creating a project where we can live close to each other in sustainable natural homes, with our workplaces near each other, grow forest gardens around us, and provide services for the community, really. We've got music and arts charity, we've got myself doing the complementary healthcare, we've got woodcrafts, straw bale building. There's quite a few of us that have just naturally come together. It's not like one person that has said, you know, this is what I'd like to do, and everybody's followed. It's like people going, oh, this is what I'd like to do, and this is what I'd like to do, and someone else going, yeah, that's the same as me, and yeah, and that's what I would like. So it's really coming together in a lovely organic way of similar people. Well, actually, I say similar, we're very diverse, but people with similar ideas of how they want to live and work. So it's been great, really great working on that since the last time I saw you, and that's been growing. And quite a few of us working Fire in the Mountain Festival, actually. So it's almost like a little, us working together even before we find the land. We work with Incredible Edo Wrexham, growing free food, and then different festivals.
How's Incredible Edible Wrexham going? Because I think those are great plans. This is growing vegetables in sort of urban spaces, is it, and the like?
The council's letting us grow on places that they can't afford to keep upkeep, so we've been growing food there. The university has given us a big plot to do a forest garden. There's a little place in National Trust that we've been given to do a forest garden, and it's just growing edible food that anybody can harvest for free.
It seems to me that this is one of the things that's really changing, because my guess is that 5 years or so ago, you probably wouldn't have found so many people that were interested in growing their own food. I don't know whether that's your impression.
Oh, definitely, and a lot of our plants get donated by lots of people growing food, even people you might not think would do it, and they are, and it's so important. It's one of the necessities you'd think of life. So, and the plants grow it for free; they give it for free, and it's quite needed. You know, the healthy food. Yeah. So I did it would be provided for free. So.
And what about actually getting land? You were talking about sustainable buildings and actually being able to build forest gardens on your own land, which I think is something that there's an ever greater move towards. Are you making any progress towards actually getting any land that you can manage?
We're getting closer and closer. We keep finding bits of land, and it's not quite right, but it's getting there. And we're looking to put it in a land trust, so that we wouldn't own a land. We'd be more stewards of the land, which we are in reality. Of course, we are in reality. Like, none of us owns the land. It's quite silly. Like, we're here for a short time. The earth's been around billions of years. To think that we own a bit is really silly in reality. But we're also looking to see how much we can do it legally wise as well, you know, and try put the land in land trust, have the plots, and different people have different plots to steward, so it's as if they own it with the same security, same rights, same responsibility, but they're more stewarding the land than owning. So we're exploring it, and it's been very interesting exploring, and also researching the different eco-villages like Lammas and Landmatter has been to, and Clock Jordan in Ireland. There's a Well Health project near Corwen. There's so many. In Tamara in Portugal is really lovely, a peace research centre. So it's been really great researching and seeing people that are already finding their way of doing it.
Have you noticed any kind of, because that's a lot of different communities, some of which are quite famous that you've mentioned there. Is there any commons, because they're all quite long-term communities, aren't they? They've lasted a long time. Do you think there's any kind of common strand between the ones that are working?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm like going in my files. Different ones work really well for different ways. You know, the ones that are working with nature, I think, and with respect to nature, I think, seem to be doing really well. Ones with shared focus and vision are working together. Yeah, different ones are working for different ways, really. But yeah, the shared community really helps, and the equality, and especially the ones working with a sense of respect to nature, really. Yeah. I'd say.
I know we had Steve Jones on last week, and he was a sort of founder member of Chicken Shack and the Llanfaslin Workhouse, and he was saying that it's really important actually to have a shared sense of purpose, that to have just people around who are just all doing their own thing just doesn't really work very well. Do you have a favourite one of those various communities that you met?
No. Yeah. They are so good in different ways. You know, I loved Ravenwood, the way in Italy that was just living within nature, you know, the trees all around. Steward Wood is like that as well, just living within the trees. I love Tamara because their shared vision is to find ways to live in peace with each other and to have that as a shared purpose, which is really... just a really lovely place, and their manifesto was, you know, almost as if I, you know, if I was going to write one, you know, I won't mind, you know, writing one like that. Ours is going to be a bit different because we're different individuals, but and Clockjaw, they're just really good in different ways, you know.
So what sort of team have you built for moving towards living in a community, and where are you thinking of doing it?
So the people that come together have got just a great range of skills. We've got Hassan, who's expert in straw bale build, and he helps teach it now, and sustainable building. We've got Mountain Music and Arts Charity that provides music and art workshop. Andy Hickey, you know, who works for them, and Mel, and Love, Light and Peace Tents, who are doing the marquees here. We've got myself doing complementary healthcare, and Liz doing complementary healthcare. We've got woodcraft work from Harry, who does really top end furniture, and so we've got Matt, who does computer skills. Juliana's here somewhere, and she, you know, she's quite good with complementary healthcare but also like property and developing. So we've got just a lovely like a range of. Of skills. Luke and Jerry. Luke does gardening. Scott and Steph. Steph was at Fire in the Mountain teaching children's yoga. And Scott's got lots of skills. We've got like a nice mix of us. So although we'll be doing our own thing, a lot of us are self-employed. We have also got that, you know, that shared vision of, you know, living and working with nature, really, as stewards and providing services to the community.
And I guess that's quite good, actually, isn't it? Because you're kind of you're having to earn your meaningless promissory tokens at the moment. But if you can get your community together, there'll be much less need for you to work, and you'll have more time, I guess, too. Because, you know, if you're sharing all of the output, all of the costs of something, as well as reducing the cost by actually being there and working in it, you'll end up reducing the amount of time you have to work. Do you think we'll still see you out at the festivals?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's it. It gives you more time to do the work that you really want to do, isn't it? You know? So, you know, the musicians will be able to do more music. I'll be able to hopefully do even more complementary healthcare and festivals. Harry currently works for somebody else, but he could be... He creates wonderful things, you know. If you ever see it, when he works for himself, it's absolutely beautiful. You know, it's something you can't buy anywhere else. You know, so he'd have more time to do that. You know, so it's one of our aims, really, is to help people fulfil their potential. So we might have more time not to do work, but then it's more time to do. Was it work when you enjoy yourself?
I don't know. I think it is. I think that's the thing. You know, those of us who are not technically fully employed are definitely very, very busy. And I still think that whatever it is you do every day, it should be a bit like it's a holiday, really, ideally. You should be doing the thing that you're good at and the thing that you love doing, which is, I'm lucky, it's what I get to spend most of my time doing, and I think you do as well, by and large.
More and more.
Yeah.
Since the training.
Yeah. So what are you doing... here at the Conscious Tribal Gathering? What are your aims for being here?
What are my aims for being here? Just felt quite called to it. At first I thought I wasn't going to be able to, and then it opened up and it's just on my doorstep. I just love it here, really. I helped hold with you and Susie and Jess and Alan opening ceremony, which was lovely. Hopefully make it through to the closing ceremony as well. Yeah. And I held a workshop in energy medicine earlier, and then I'm going to be offering therapeutic massage, energy massage, some of the energy work, and some guided journeying as well. Yeah, I found since our last interview a word. I was thinking, shaman. You know, that's a word for it. You know, that's a word to describe, that could describe some of the work I do. But I found the word for this country, what they call it in this country, the Awenid. Awenid.
Awenid, as in Awen.
Yeah, and it's somebody that dips into the Awen, that universal wisdom and experience. Like imagine it's like a river, and anybody can dip into that flowing wisdom and experience, dip in and bring it back and share it with the world. And that's what we're all doing. So Awenith, I like dipping in the Awen.
Yeah, I think Awenith is really great, because shaman is definitely not a word that's associated necessarily with our native peoples. And it's very much our native path that you're following in your medicine teaching, isn't it? Why did you become interested in medicine healing and using energy to help people out?
It's a bit of a long story. I'll try to keep it brief. Okay, so when I was younger, I'd get insights, possible things of wisdom, you know, what some people call awakenings, enlightenings. I don't really use that word, but I got them, like many of us are getting at the moment, it seems. But I kind of ignored them, and then I got ill, and then I got really ill, and then I got bedbound, really bedbound in writhing pain most of the time, and just couldn't move. And during this time, I wrote a blog of some of my experiences or some of my insights as a, not taking them seriously, just sort of a, oh, this brain exercises, imagine if this was true. Well, you know, let's stretch your brain a bit, like, you know, make it work to think if it's true. And somebody read it and then gave me a book and said, I think you're talking about what this person's talking about. Yeah. And I read it and it was like, oh my word.
isn't it funny when you come across something in a book that really resonates with what you're experiencing?
And not only did it say similar things, it also explained it in much more depth and techniques. And I tried with this, you know, I had an operation, so that's where my the total knock on my face happened. And I was stuck in bed like 99% of the time. I tried mainstream medicine, I tried so many things. I won't list them, because they all help. All the other alternative things helped for short term but not long term. So basically, and the doctor said, you're not going to get better. Then one later on said, oh, you're just going to get worse. And I was I was quite young at the time, and I said,
neither of which are particularly helpful.
No, but it was quite helpful for me, because I was like, nope, I'm not having that. Yeah. And so I had to do it. And I had to say it for this, the guy that did the book, he runs the Four Wind Society. So that was the first person that I trained with.
What was the book that made such a difference?
Oh, Shaman Healer Sage by Alberto Villoldo. Especially when he talks about his teacher, Don Jikaram. Mm. Don Jikaram's words, it was like, yeah. So I had no choice really but to do this training or stay ill, really. I didn't know for sure it would make me better, but I went there and it felt good. I was like, right, follow my heart, I'll do it. And I did it. So I had to save up for a year to be able to afford the first course. When I went there, I had to lie on the floor for most of the time. So it's a bit of a struggle, me to the work.
How long was that first course?
You do the south first, then the west, then the north and east. So that was over, and then you do master's classes. So that was over a number of years, but not too many. It used to take lifetimes, but I think it took about maybe 4 years or something to do, or 5 years to do them all. And then I went round it again, like the medicine wheel journey: the south, the west, the north, and the east into centre. I didn't went around it again to learn how to teach it, because when you first go around it's like four. But I went around it again to learn to teach it, and now I'm going around it again teaching it now, which is really lovely.
I guess going around it the first time as a healing journey, and the second time as an affirmation, and the third time to teach, they must actually have been pretty different experiences, I would have thought.
It is, and all of them are healing, and all of them are learning as well at the same time, so it's been really good. And I'm learning, you know, people come and are learning with me when I'm sharing the work. I'm learning from them as well, which is really, really nice. Like I was saying to you earlier, you know, before, you'd be teachers say, people listen and just take the word for it. But now it's more about facilitating. It's about sharing experiences. And if you come from that place of facilitating that access to the inner wisdom, facilitating the access to that AWEN, the universal wisdom, then you get to learn as well. And it's just really, quite magical.
And it really comes quite easily once you start paying attention to it. I enjoyed the energy work that we did earlier on, but we've talked before on the show about the fact that if you sit amongst kind of ancient trees and just feel, just sit and give a bit of space for being watched and listened to by the trees instead of just watching and listening to the trees, you can really feel that energy all around you. And it seems to me that that's one of the things that we're really seeing a resurgence in now. It's why we were talking when we were a little bit off air about the fact that a lot of people are starting to make these really deeply alternative decisions, but from within. It's not because they're being forced from without. And it seems to me that the spirit of things is coming back to us. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, it definitely feels that way. And it makes sense. There's been so much fear in the past, like, have to control people so that they act like good people. It's like, if any of those, like, whoever... controllers are listening, it's like, oh, actually, how about teaching them in their own moral compasses, how to access their own moral compasses, their own way of being, their own way of happiness and joy? Then don't have to control anybody then, do you? You can, and then you get to experience the richness of the inner wisdom that's within them, and that they can access and bring to the world. It's, you know, finding our own way.
Because that's what it is, isn't it? Everybody has something special to offer, and the more we can kind of open it up to them through ceremony and through these traditional techniques, then the more awakened and happy people we'll have, and that actually changes the world, doesn't it?
Yeah. As we transform people, we transform the world.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I feel, and it benefits us, it benefits the world around us, it benefits them, and it's just quite amazing. Like I say to people, like, you know, you don't need to do my training at all, the training that I offer, because, you know, you've got that access already to inner wisdom and universal wisdom anyway. But, you know, if you want a bit of assistance, then I'm there to provide that assistance. And and it's really handy. It's kind of like, my route would have been a lot longer if it wasn't for the training, put it that way. I might have found the answers eventually, but it would have taken a lot longer. So it's really great to have people passing on the wisdom and experience that they learn. And again, that's the work of the Awenith, that they go and they learn and they bring it back to the share with the world. And you don't need to box it off either, you know, like how people are done with religions, when teachers have gone dipped into the Awen, brought back the wisdom to share with the world, and people thought, oh, I've got to box it off. Well, you don't need to. It's a flowing river. You can just dip back in and access it any time. So,
and it's an amazing thing. I still find it, although I've been familiar with it for a while, this idea that these ancient peoples with ancient ideas and myths are genuinely accessing information from a resonant level. I mean, perhaps 15, 20 years ago in this country, people would have found it a bit occult and very difficult to take on board, the idea that information comes from around us, from the plant world, from all manner of things. But now there's been quite a lot of studies into ayahuasca and and even here, you know, in the lands of Albion, where they've gone investigating into the old the kind of kludges and shit pits of the old monasteries, they've found mixtures of seeds that suggest that people knew then how to heal. And this is information that we're coming across once again, the kind of magic of nature is teaching us truths that we might have forgotten.
Well, yeah, thank goodness, you know, that there is that tradition, isn't it? They say, what do they say, that, you know, that for a while we decided to go off that kind of connection, that path, for a bit, just to experience what it's like, you know, not to have that connection, not to have that awareness, not to have that learning. So, like, well, we've done that, okay. It can come back again now to the nature. And in a way, it can be, you know, connecting with the indigenous wisdom that's still being used.
So, what do you think is the most important difference between your view of the world and your approach to healing and that of the Orthodox world? What do you think is the most important thing you do that isn't generally done?
It's a lot similar. I was going to say I encourage the self-healing within them. So, like, my friend calls me a healer, I'm like, and she always corrects herself, going, yeah, no, Katie, you wouldn't say that you're a healer because you help people self-heal themselves. And I'm like, yeah, she still comes to it sometimes. But then again, I suppose mainstream medicine ideally would do that. They'd do something to help the body heal themselves. No, they don't do that very much, do they?
No, it is technically what's happening. Whenever people do heal, they are genuinely, they're generally healing themselves. But yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So I think it's important to help. It does seem that we've all got our capacity to self-heal, and it's different ways you can use to help people self-heal. Heal themselves, and mainstream medicine could probably do that a bit more really than they do.
Yeah, indeed. So you've been in the UK most of the time. Are you planning any more trips to foreign parts and a bit more training for yourself, or you're going to stay here a teaching and a healing?
You mean helping people self-heal? Yeah. And yeah. Healing myself, though.
Yeah.
Got a lot of work to do there. I'm not sure. I've gone a little bit homebody at the moment, and I'm really feeling to share the work, you know, around the place and around the people that have been asking me to do the training, so, and to keep developing these forest gardens. So, I expect there's more. Oh, I'm learning a lot from, you know, I'm doing training, but it's like learning, like you said, from nature at the moment, you know, nature.
I guess that doing the gardening and things actually is probably the biggest extension to your education you can have, isn't it?
Helps. Yeah, it helps, but then I'm literally learning. So there's one exercise, a breathing exercise that I do. I was doing that and I learnt from the earth, and like a little addition to that exercise, which is to, like, send your awareness down deep into the earth. And then when you feel a real connection to the centre of the earth, I kind of learnt from the earth to actually just take a moment to breathe with the earth energy and just to breathe with that earth energy and feel that connection. So again, to me, it was the earth teaching me that. That's where it felt like it came from, the thoughts or the impetuous. And then I was reading a book and found that some people do that exercise anyway. I was like, oh, okay.
Which is, I guess, exactly the point you're making about the fact that this comes from an ancient body of knowledge that we have access to. I mean, Rupert Sheldrake might have called it the morphogenetic field, or Jung called it the collective unconscious. Yeah. But it is everything that humanity has learnt and done is accessible to us, and you're basically helping people find a way through that for themselves.
Yeah, I love it. And then they get to come back with the wisdom, and also, of course, that universal wisdom experience, as well as accessing it, we can add to it as well.
Yeah.
And wow, people are so wise. When people come back with those, from a session or whatever, with those insights, it's just like, whoa, of course. And a lot of things they say is like, oh, of course, that makes perfect sense, but you just hadn't thought of it in that way before.
And do you find people take to it quite easily once they're introduced to it?
Oh, I think that's a question.
I suppose horses for courses. I suppose there's some that do and some that don't. Have you ever had people run away from you in absolute horror?
Not yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if that happened someday, you know, because we've all got our triggers, we've all got reactions. So far, the people I've been working with have really quite amazed me, really, how naturally they're taking to, you know, things that took some, you know, well, different people have affinity to different parts of the work, but, you know, there's some bits of work that took me quite a while to get a hold on, and they just come and just, like, doof, and can do it straight away, but...
I think again that's something that we probably wouldn't have seen 10 years ago. It is a kind of, there's a sort of magic arising in people,
an easier access or a quicker learning. A lot of us sort of feeling that, aren't we, that we're learning a lot of lessons, where there's something, you maybe learn one or two massive life lessons in life, and all of a sudden we're like, yeah, loads of life lessons.
Well, I think that, I mean, this gathering itself here is an example of that movement for me, because really it's a kind of offshoot of a Truth Juice gathering.
And I found those, like, because the internet's really good for lots of information, I think that's generally acknowledged, but I find that being in real space with real people is, it works a lot better for me. And the Truth gatherings with 3 or 4 days of people talking about everything from energy attachments through UFOs and crop circles to the law meant that it was a real education. And I don't think that such things as this actually were happening up until a few years ago. And now we've got this magnificent field full of people and presenters, and I think almost everybody who's here has probably got a story to tell.
I think so. Really amazing group of people that have naturally to come together, really. It's really feel it in the heart.
Yeah. One of the great things about them, and I think it's kind of we've all been running a little bit behind today, as I think thought. But I should imagine we'll kick off on time tomorrow. So what I'll do is I'll say, hey, there's some kids in the background. Also, you might have caught the distant sound of a gong bath over there. I don't know whether this microphone was picking that up or not. But what I'm going to do is there's no sign of anybody outside the tent. And as those of you who listen regularly to these live festival broadcasts will realise that once it starts getting dark, it gets harder to hunt the guests down. So I'm going to put on a couple of tunes or so. And then hopefully we'll come back to you with somebody else. And thanks very much, Katie. Oh, it's really great.
Really great talk to you. It's so great just to chat and find that we're finding similar things in this world, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And all the best with the housing project, because I think there's more and more people now. You listed a fantastic group of skills there, and there's now lots and lots of people who, given the opportunity to live and work together, would really be taking advantage of it, I think. So you'll have to keep us up to date on how that goes.
Will do, that would be great.
And any other communities you visit as well. In the meantime, here's Dexter Dextrous and his Fingersmiths, and That's Life. After this, I'm not sure what's happening, but I'm sure something will. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com. That was Dreadzone and Love, Life and Unity. Life, Love and Unity. And we're coming to you live from the Conscious Tribal Gathering, where at the moment, actually, most of the people that we're hoping to talk to on the show are in the gong bath, which you can't hear because it's gone spookily quiet. So we're, I think, literally more or less the entire field's in there, apart from me and Jay. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Doc. Hi, everyone in the chat box.
We have a bit of the kitchen posse in here. We've also got Steve, who's come to talk to us. Don't know how long the gong bath will go on, Steve, but it's really good to see you again. I've been seeing you at Truth Juice gigs for ages. You must have been in more or less from the beginning. What are you doing here?
Well, what I'm doing here is that, funnily enough, talking to Katie a few years ago, and she was saying about booking somewhere and doing some workshops and talks and stuff like that. But the place we were thinking of booking was too expensive. So before I could do anything like the following year, Conscious Camp turned up, and it's like, hey, that's just what I want to do, and somebody's already organised it for me, and they've got all the speakers, and all I've got to do is turn up. Brilliant. So I came along to that, and then had such a good time. And the reason why I'm here this time, as usual, is that I come along to have a bit of fun, meet old and new friends, to have a laugh, do something silly, learn something new, and whatever happens, to just thoroughly enjoy myself. And hey presto, that's exactly what happens. It's kind of like I created my own reality, which is what I gave the talk on in the first place when I first came here. So that's the other thing I love doing here, is because I get a chance to talk to people about what I've learnt, and especially within the realms of how we create our own reality by the way we think and behave. I mean, it's interesting, it's a conscious camp, and the word conscious consists of two Latin words. Con meaning with, and skios meaning I know. Now, the word know, to me, is short for karma now. And karma stands for knowledge, and reason means awareness. So when I am aware with knowledge of the consequences of my thoughts and actions, then I am aware of my karma now. I know what will happen in the future. I'm just unaware of when. You know what I mean? Which is different knowledge from knowing that the capital of France is F. Yeah. If you get the drift. So if I'm aware of the consequences of my thoughts and actions, then the more I consider what it is I want and how I behave, the more I am able to create what it is I desire. Now, there was a guy around a couple of thousand years ago, and he said, there is only one law, but it's actually a principle. However, God gave Moses 10 to explain it, and Moses, thinking that the people be frightened for their survival while they were wandering through the desert, asked if he could give them 100. However, the Pharisees and the Sadducees have given us 100 times 100 laws, which place an impossible burden upon you, the people, but from which they themselves are exempt. Hardly any change there, then, eh? And then he said, the angels have given you 7, and I am giving you 3, the greatest of which is the first. Love your God with your whole heart, your whole mind, and your whole soul. Love your neighbour as yourself. And although men of old have told you to love your hate your enemies, I am telling you to love them. Brilliant. So, what is the one law? It's the law of cause and effect, karma, or we reap what we sow. Eastern, Western, and scientific. So, if that's what it means, then if I love my neighbours, then my neighbours will love me. If I love my enemies, they will love me. And the reason why the first one is the greatest is because I am my God. And if I am unable to love myself, how can I love anybody else? And I am my God because I am the one who creates my own reality. Boss.
And we're not taught a lot to love ourselves, are we? Let alone love other people.
The religious idea is for us to feel bad so that we offer sacrifices to those who intercede on our behalf, and then they're the ones who seem to end up breaking at all the offerings. Yeah. It's still going on today.
I'll just answer Mahat. The current guest tonight, Mahat, is Steve, because you can possibly hear in the background there's a gong bath going on, and that's where all the other potential guests are at the moment, so I don't know how they're going to be handling the mic later on. So we're having a bit of a chat with Steve, and basically, so are you finding that, having concluded, and I think quite probably correctly, that what you think and what you intend actually makes a difference to how things turn out, has that enabled you to make things run a bit more smoothly for yourself, or has it just got more excited?
Well, I'm beginning to learn to sort of let it go and things like that. I mean, for instance, I tipped up here without a bucket, and in the bucket was a pan, a bowl, spoon and all that, and a cup and one thing and another, and somehow or other I managed to gather those things together from other people. So, you know, I thought, do I want to do a 100-mile round trip just to pick up a pan and a bucket and a bowl? Surely something else can happen. So, yeah, in that respect. And it's also when I'm trying to rush to get somewhere, and then I think, well, I'll just get there at the right time. So stop worrying about it. It'll just happen when it's supposed to happen.
I think that's absolutely correct. That is something that I've noticed over the last 3 or 4 years as well. I put myself under quite a lot of pressure to kind of fulfil an appointment or whatever the terms we might use are. And by and large, even if I turn up 3, 4, 5 hours later than I intended, it's still exactly the right time to turn up. And I, more and more, I tend to think that that's the way life is actually working, but that I just don't get to concentrate on it. That it does work as a result of synchronicity and your intent. And you know, kind of your inner you somehow knows when you need to arrive, irrespective of what time you thought it was going to be on the watch.
I agree with that. There was something I was going to say. The thing is that, as far as I'm concerned, the universe is totally positive. And because it's totally positive, it's unable to understand negative words, such as no, or not, never, neither, neither, nor, nobody, nothing, or none. They are all not words, not ever, not either. And any words ending in an apostrophe T. So my negative side tells me what it doesn't want. And the universe gives me what I don't want. Because it also gives me what I want, and it gives me what I don't want. So until I stop thinking about what I don't want, and start thinking positively about what I do, it kind of makes it difficult for it to actually happen.
Yeah.
For example, if I say I mustn't forget to do something, I do.
Yeah.
If I say I must remember to do something, then I do. But the only difference between not, I think the word not stands for no time to think, because the ego just consists of chemical reactions, whereas it's the spirit who uses light to transfer its positive thoughts and messages around our brain and body. And whereas the other one comes from chemicals which we ingest through our skin, through the air we breathe, and through the foods we eat and the drugs we take or whatever else it is. They're the things that supply us with the electrons that causes our negative, thoughtless, reactive behaviour to kick in. You know, if I hit you, then if you hit me and I hit you, then it means sometime in the future somebody will do it to me. So that's why I look at it. And so, unless I can think, to get what I want, I have to think about it in advance. For example, if I say to somebody, I don't mean this, well, as far as I'm concerned, I live in a universe full of infinite possibilities, and to say I don't mean that one is kind of like thoughtless and meaningless than it is to the universe.
So you try to be a bit more precise in what you do say to people.
Well, I mean, I was talking to Christy OJ the other day giving a talk, and he was saying, you know, all words are spells.
Yeah.
That's why we spell them.
Yeah.
And, for example, he said something like, you think back into the past when somebody said something to you which hurt your feelings, or and how you felt about it, and how long that feeling lasted. Well, for that to happen, then that word must have been spells.
Yeah.
And it's just magic. But we fail to realise that the consequences of the sounds and the words that we use will determine how we create our own reality.
And that Chris Diogi is the artist previously known as Darren Diogi.
That's the guy you're talking about, yeah. So, the thing is that sound seems to form matter, so unless we think about what we're saying, I mean, for example, we've seen those photographs of water is frozen after it's been microwaved and influenced in some way just by sound. And the other one is where you have the screen on its back and you've got a speaker on its back, and some metal on top with some sand or something like that. And you whack it up through a frequency generator and you start at a very low frequency. And the sound bounces around, and then all of a sudden it starts to form itself into a simple pattern or shape. And then it goes higher, and then it all disrupts and spreads itself out over the surface. And then it comes back with a more complex one. And it keeps doing that, the higher and higher the frequencies. But the patterns become more precise and more complex. And what's going on in the world today, as far as I'm aware or concerned, is we're going through the jumbly bounce, although jumping the chaos phase, so that out of that can come the next phase of our evolution.
Which will be a whole new pattern.
Yeah.
And, that's cymatics, that is, isn't it?
Yeah.
The emergence of complex patterns through frequency. And by sheer coincidence, we're joined by Rob Buckle, who's here to talk about pyramids and crop circles. And I wonder if you think whether cymatics has got anything to do with the way crop circles form.
Well, not that I've come across. Although the way circle makers get their inspiration may be influenced by things like that.
Yeah.
But I have a slightly different belief about how crop circles are formed. Most of it, through my research, it's quite clear that it comes through humans. but that there's a whole other story to be told there as well. So,
yeah, I think that's a very important point. So, I guess there's a couple of questions there. One is, are all crops, do you think all crop circles are created by humans? And then what do you think it is that's manifesting in the humans that's doing such amazing work late at night in the fields?
Well, to answer the first question, I think it's quite clear to me that all of the circles that you'll see this year and in the last few years at the very least have been man-made. And I would say that there's a small element, there is a mystery to them in terms of how they came about, a very small percentage, and mostly the very early simple circles, just a plain circle. Those were sort of in the late 70s, early 80s, and how they came about in the first instance is a little bit more of a mystery. So I've got an open mind about them. But as the subject evolved, humans invariably took over, and it's the whole subject has been through humans since then. But it's not a simple case of these are just hoaxed formations, there's people just going out in the field and having a laugh and making crop circles just for the hell of it. There is something else at play, and it comes into where you're asking the question about how they get their inspiration and things like that. Well, that's the biggest mystery, and that's why I'm interested in the subject, because there seems to be another element at play here. There seems to be something else directing it. It seems that the people that have been involved in circle making are picking up on something in a wider consciousness that is almost guiding this process. It's as if the whole subject had to happen.
So what is it that gives you that impression? Obviously, you've spoken extensively with the circle makers, and I saw your talk at the Stonehenge Truce Juice gig, which I really enjoyed. I'm thoroughly looking forward to this outing of yours. But what is it? Are there specific things that have given you cause to wonder what it is that's coming through these people?
Well, it's when you start to see that a human-made circle has incredible properties to it. It influences the energy field, and this has even been picked up on Geiger counters and all sorts of things. And this is where initially researchers were saying it's impossible that this could be a man-made circle, because this particular formation has changed the energy field. We can see the physical evidence on our Geiger counters, and humans can't do that. So there must be something else at play. Yet some researchers have actually witnessed these being made. There's Simeon Hine actually watched Matthew Williams and his team make a formation, witnessed the whole thing from start to finish. They took readings before they made the formation in the field to make sure that there was nothing there that they could pick up with the Geiger counters and so on. And they took readings during and after the formation. And after the formation had been completed, the Geiger counters were going off the scale. The energy readings were enormous from that. And Simeon was saying that he'd never come across a circle that had such high readings as that. And he couldn't explain that. So he started to look at the human element of that and what's actually going on here with involving humans. There seems to be some interplay between the fact that the humans are getting involved in this, and they're putting down a design, a geometric design, often based on sacred geometry principles, and interacting with the live crop itself seems to be producing something incredible.
I can't help wondering whether it's the geometries that are actually being used, because whilst humans might not be able to do that sort of thing, geometry certainly can.
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, even a simple circle has enormous power. And I think crop circles are very much linked to the idea of stone circles and how they were originally created and what they were used for. The fact that you're putting down a simple circle and it's used for ceremony, it's used as a sacred space, and it creates something magical. And yes, I think the geometric design, every geometric design has its own imprint on the land, and is creating a frequency that is interacting with the earth. And that, I think, is having a massive change. But I think it has to have the human input. Without the human element, there's some part of the magic missing. And this is what a lot of my talk is going to be about tomorrow, and how there's three key elements that make up what I call the magic of crop circles. And that is the earth element, which we've already mentioned, the spirit element, and the human element. Those three parts then produce something magical. And in terms of the spirit interaction, there is a lot of interaction of otherworldly entities, shall we say. And I've experienced some of this as well around crop circles. It seems almost as if the crop circle itself is opening up a temporary portal. And there's a lot of interactions, a lot of what you might call paranormal activity happens around it. People have seen entities, there's been balls of light, lots of reports of balls of light, and just lots of strange phenomena.
You've actually got some amazing photos of the balls of light, if I remember rightly, haven't you? And they're moving, they seem to be coming towards the camera, and they're not like, just for people who are listening, they're not like the orbs that we see in static photographs. They're really lively things that the cameraman's obviously engaged with.
Yes, there have been some incredible footage taken of balls of light, particularly around crop circles as well. So there seems to be an interaction between them, and I've got my own ideas about what these balls of lights are.
Go on then, let's hear them.
Well, I think there's different levels of balls of light. It's almost like a hierarchy, if you like. But there's the ones that you described that you might pick up on photographs, which are very opaque kind of balls of light, which you don't actually see with the naked eye. And there's others that you can see with the naked eye, which are larger, more formed, and particularly at night you will pick them up. You'll see, I mean, I've myself have witnessed quite a few of those in the Wiltshire area. There's a few of them have been out on night watches, particularly looking for this kind of phenomenon, because it's, you know, it's renowned in that area in Wiltshire, particularly around the ancient sites, that you will often get sightings of strange phenomena, balls of light being probably the most common. And these things I've seen literally rise up off the ground, hover in the air, move around, drop back down again. I've seen them moving at speed across the sky. And I haven't actually got footage of those, but other people have. Mm. But I think they're certainly intelligent. There is an intelligent aspect to that. I think it's linked to ancient ancestors. And there's other stories as well that I can tell you which go a little bit further than that. But do you want to wait till tomorrow? Or?
It's good to chat about them now. But we can always chat about it again when I've heard you talk. So have you got any theories as to what these otherworldly characters are that's involved in this schema, and how are the humans related to them? I mean, do they feel that there's some kind of intercommunication going on, or do they just feel motivated from within to go and do incredible geometrical landscaping feats?
It's a bit of both, actually. Sometimes the circle makers aren't actually aware of that interaction going on to that extent. They feel as if something's going on, but they're not quite sure what it is. But others are actively trying to engage in that interaction and are aware of that. I think it's all part of the collective consciousness, and humans are tapping into that, and this consciousness goes across the dimensions and across time, you know. So it's, I think we're interacting with ancient ancestors and also possibly beings from other dimensions, which I think are also linked to the human race in some ways. And I think this is what I'm trying to explore now in terms of the portal aspect of crop circles and the Wiltshire area. There's a lot of evidence suggesting that there are active portals in that area that are interdimensional.
And have you seen any evidence of what's coming through these portals? I mean, and do you think that these are generally beneficial influences?
Well, I think the balls of light are certainly evidence of things coming through that. There's been hundreds, thousands of UFO sightings in that area as well, the Wiltshire area, which we're talking about, areas like Avebury, Stonehenge, Silbury Hill. Many, many sightings of UFOs and other strange phenomena, alien beings, or what we'd call alien beings, but just, you know, not quite human beings. But whether the intentions are always positive, I'm not entirely sure. There's some evidence to suggest that it's not. I know a number of people that have encountered beings who are just simply black, you know, shadow beings, some people call them, but just black figures, and they seem to have a bit of an ominous presence. They seem to be a little bit intimidating. I've even been known to chase people out of fields. Circle makers have been chased out of fields by these things. I know people who've had quite frightening experiences from that. But on the other hand, there's been encounters that have been very positive. So it's very difficult to say what, if there is an overall intention, what that is. But it seems to be that we are interacting with other dimensions of some sort, and maybe it's not all under our control. Maybe we're opening up windows and it's allowing in all sorts of energies, some good, some bad.
And what is it about those? I mean, I thought I'd seen wood engravings of kind of crop circles from back in the 17th, 18th century, but you should say that the earliest ones are sort of 1970s. What is it that's difficult to explain about those early ones?
Well, the one that you're referring to, I think, comes from an ancient tale of the mowing devil.
Yeah, that's the one.
That's it. And there is a wood carving depicting a little devil creature cutting down the crop. I don't know if that is the same thing, but it does show the figure cutting the crop rather than laying it down. Yeah. So it may be slightly different. It may have just been a case of sabotage in the field from somebody. I don't know. And there has been many reports. Farmers have said there's been reports that they've seen crop circles or circles of flattened crop in their land for many decades, and they haven't reported it to anybody. So sometimes it could be wind damage, sometimes it could be a natural phenomenon. I'm not entirely sure what they've seen, but the modern phenomena as we know it sort of kicked off around the late 70s, early 80s, and very slowly did it enter the public consciousness. And it was really only when it did that things started to get complicated, and we started getting more of the complex designs creeping in, and it sort of peaked well after it seemed to have ended. It was all exposed around 1991, with Doug and Dave being unmasked as being responsible for a lot of the circles. That wasn't the case. They weren't the only ones doing that, and there was a lot of unexplained things going on as well. But it sort of died away for a few years, and then it re-emerged with the great complexity that we're familiar with. So there was like different phases to it, and I think there's an element of control in that, in terms of how it happened, and that's quite a big area I probably haven't got time to go into at the moment. But I do feel as if there's been some cover-up in terms of what this is all about, and there's been a lot of research has been putting out misinformation about what this is all about, trying to lead us down the path that it's only aliens, say only aliens, because that, I don't think, is as big as realising that it's something to do with us and we're actually capable of so much. But when we actually realise what we're capable of, and we are capable of interacting with multiple dimensions and producing fantastic works of art in a few hours in the dead of night, as they do, we start to suddenly realise, gosh, we can do something here. And I think it's that element that has always been suppressed. And you'll find most crop circle researchers won't go down this route. They won't necessarily say it's all aliens, but they won't say it's all humans. They like to keep the element of mystery to it, and they will not talk about the circle maker's story. And I'm one of a very few numbers of researchers that will actually talk about the circle maker's story, you know, in itself. And I think that's the most interesting part of it, because they have such incredible stories to tell.
Are there a lot of circle makers? I mean, they presumably work into... I mean, I'll be honest, I look at what they're doing as a kind of amateur geometer, and every now and then I've seen the keys and I've tried to mimic on a piece of paper what's being done in the field. And I'm also a landscaper, and I generally, even for a simple garden, I'll allow a couple of people a couple of days to mark out a garden, which is nothing like what we're talking about here. I mean, they're obviously tremendously... sophisticated in the techniques they've got and the ways they can plan things and execute them. I mean, how many teams of them are there, do you know?
There are, or there have been, quite a number of teams, but there's only certain key circle makers that are the ones that are coming up with the designs and are really responsible for so many things. I couldn't put a number on that. I don't know them all personally. I know certain ones, and I know of many others, but there are, I would say, a relative handful of very, very expert circle makers. One of them I can actually name, because he publicly, he doesn't do crop circles anymore. He's come out, and he now does sand circles. It's a guy called Julian Richardson, and you can see the sand circles that he produces are of the same standard. They are absolutely phenomenal as well. And he produces these designs on a beach in between tides in around about 4 to 5 hours length of time. And that is approximately the same length of time it would take them to do a crop circle in the dead of night. The only difference is, you know, with the light aspect. But people always say, well, it's impossible to see anything out in the dark. Well, I've actually experience being out with a team on one occasion, and you can see surprisingly well when your eyes adjust to it. And they are incredibly organized, and they do these things they take it seriously, and they often will have a spiritual element to it as well. They'll do a ceremony before they begin, and they'll ask for guidance, they'll ask for inspiration, these kind of things, so that they'll put a good intention on it. So there seems to be also, I think, another element to it that makes it so perfect. So they're interacting with something that actually makes it the perfect design that it is. Sometimes they're not even aware of certain coincidences and certain things that happen that actually make the crop circle what it is. And everybody talks about that aspect of it, maybe the positioning of it or the relationship with certain features of the land, or it may even be a mistake they've made on it that actually turns out to be something very significant which they hadn't even planned.
So that makes it quite, if it is, it's all people deciding where to put these things, it makes it interesting that they're staying so centred around Wiltshire and Barbary Castle and all of these ancient sites, because they don't roam much, do they? I mean, there's a lot of crops in a lot of fields that nobody ever goes anywhere near. Do we know why they're doing it in the ancient places?
Well, I think it's just this area around Wiltshire is just such a powerful area for earth energies. And they're drawn to those areas. It's not so much the case at the moment. It seems to have moved away quite a bit. I mean, there has been crop circles cropped up all over the country, but Wiltshire is, for the majority of the time, that was about where 90%, 80% at least of the crop circles were. But if you go to that area and explore that area, you can see why. It's just rich in history, and it has an energy about the place, and it all adds to the magic. And there is an element of the circle makers wanting to add to that magic as well. And I do honestly feel they are drawn to that area because that's where they seem to get these experiences. Like I've explained before, you know, on the night watches, quite often you will see balls of light. People have reported entities, and this seems to be the hub of a lot of otherworldly activity. And that's why I think it's possibly linked to portals, and there is evidence of that historically as well.
So are we getting any closer to understanding by going out on the night watches and taking documentary evidence and all of that? Do you think we're getting any closer to finding out what is actually happening?
Well, I'd like to think so. You'll have to come to my talk tomorrow to find out.
I'll be there.
But I think we are moving towards, well, I think I am anyway, but the most researchers still seem to be hooked up on keeping the mystery going. And this is the biggest problem with the subject, that most researchers they've made it into a business. And that's always a mistake when you're dealing with something like this, because you have vested interest in something. But if your vested interest is only the truth, you have to constantly keep changing your story, because I've changed my view on this subject all the time, because the more you research into something, the more you uncover that what you first believed isn't quite the case. But it's totally wrong to say, well, that didn't fit with my belief, so I'm going to ignore that and I'm going to stick with this, which is what most researchers are doing. And this is why the subject does seem to keep going round and round in circles, if you pardon the pun.
It's really exciting. I'm looking forward very much to hearing your talk. Do you include pyramids now in your subject matter? Is that because there turns out to be a connection between the crop circles and the pyramids, or is it just a new area of interest?
Well, it's always been an area of interest for me, but I do see parallels between crop circles and sacred sites generally, and there's a lot of similarities between what makes up a crop circle and what constitutes to the magic of pyramids as well. And this is the connection between the spirit energy, the earth energy, and the human input. And I think what the ancient ancestors, the builders of the pyramids and some of the great sites around the world, what they knew was how to connect all this together. And this is really where I'm going with my research, and is saying, well, okay, we can now say, yes, people can make crop circles, but what else can they do? And we're actually going back in time now and saying, look, we used to do this. We could make pyramids of this standard. People still are in awe of the Great Pyramid of Giza, because we cannot do that now, or we think we can't do that now. But this is what I believe, is we can, but we have to use our minds in the correct way, and we have to interact with nature in the right way, we have to interact with spirit in the right way, and stop playing silly games and pretending this doesn't exist, and giving our power to believing it's all aliens and all this kind of thing. When we start to look at ourselves and what we can do amazing things, and our ancient ancestors proved that, and I think that's where we now need to go, in that direction.
That's absolutely great. Thank you very much, Rob. I think that's a really good place to leave it. Thank you. I'll definitely come and catch up with your talk, and perhaps we'll get to talk some more.
Yep.
But thanks very much for making time for Dr. Rock's radio show tonight.
We've got
a few people in the tent around us, so I'm going to put on another couple of tunes whilst we sort out what happens next. to excuse, I haven't quite got the microphone I was hoping for, so I'm going to play you, Not For Me by the John Preston Tribute Band, and we'll have a chat at this end, and we'll be back with you in 8 or 9 minutes or so. Thanks for being there, folks. That was Chris Barber and Guy Barker and Angle Grinder Blues from Jules Holland's Rhythm and Blues Orchestra. I think their first CD there. I've still got Rob here because I realise there's a few things that I forgot to ask him. One of the things is that, as he said, he's a man who's seen people making crop circles. So I'm just wondering what sort of basic techniques he uses. How are they doing that amazing stuff with crops in the dark in a field? What sort of tools are they using?
Well, it's surprisingly simple, actually. I think as long as the team are organised, it's incredible what they can achieve with very simple tools. And the main tools are board stompers or rollers for certain flattened areas. And they will use marker poles for the more complex formations. Other than that, there is surveyor's tape. And not much else, to be honest.
That's amazing, because again, one of the things that brings to my mind is the fact that what you're getting is just amazingly complex and beautiful things using the methods the old geometers use, which are basically straight edges and radii.
Yeah, the secret really is being organised, and people can't comprehend the amount of planning that they would go into some of this with the top circle makers. There are others that will do things a little bit more spontaneously, but the ones that most people seem to be familiar with, the big incredible designs, they're actually less of those than people think in terms of the number proportion of all the crop circles. So I mean, out of a season, generally speaking, you would get around about 50 to 60, maybe more, crop circles in 1 year. But out of those, you'd probably get about half a dozen to a dozen maximum that are of a very high standard.
And that's because there's very few top-grade teams operating, and you seem to think, at least at the moment, it's a thing of the past.
I think at the moment, yeah, the subject seems to be fading a little bit. I think it peaked around about 2009, 2010. Since then, a lot of the top circle makers have moved on because there's so much politics in that subject. It's unbelievable. And they feel as if they're being treated like criminals all the time, or they are treated like criminals. And even by the circle researchers who make their living from their work, they're still treated as if they're criminals. And it's a strange paradox, and a lot of them have moved on, but the subjects still seem to limp on, but with newer, less experienced teams.
So why do you think they are treated like criminals? It's not just because of what they do to the crops, is it? I mean, do the military have an interest in what these people are doing? Because it strikes me that if they're being gainsaid, and if people are wanting to see them marginalised and things like that, it's possibly because they're involved in something that's important and worthy of notice.
Yeah, well, that's an element that I've looked at as well, I've considered. That, there certainly can't be any admission from most circle makers that the best circles are man-made. And even though some of them are actually even made to order, believe it or not, by some of the researchers, they still won't acknowledge that publicly. They'll still make it seem as if there's a mystery behind it when they know it's not. There's so many different elements to this subject, it's unbelievable. And there are some connections, I believe, to intelligence services, which has muddied the waters even more. Some circle makers have had connections there in the past. Certainly not all. Most of them will not have. Most researchers don't have. But and this is not something I know, but I certainly believe there must be some other influence on researchers and some circle makers to keep the subject along the lines that it can be controlled. The lines that I'm going down, looking at the human element to it, can't be controlled so much because it opens up a whole new area. As long as people are prepared to believe it's aliens, they're quite happy with that because it's of no danger, it's of no threat to anybody, and it's just a little, you know, trivial subject.
I find that really interesting, that the idea that it might all be done by aliens is a trivial subject, whereas the fact that it's done by humans is really regarded as worthy of keeping quiet.
Well, I say trivial in the sense that most people won't take it seriously. It's just seen as a little, you know, a little bit of a minority interest. So people don't really take it that seriously. But when you start to say there's something going on with humans here, and we can, you know, scientifically start testing this kind of thing, it opens up a massive new area. And that's where I think they don't want to go.
Yeah, because I know that there was a reasonable bit of research done with Hamish Miller when he was dowsing. They used a computer and electrodes on his head to see that he was using his brain differently when he was dowsing than when he wasn't dowsing. And my guess is the same thing's happening with the Circle Makers. So before we let you go, are there any books or websites of yours that you'd like to recommend for people?
Well, I've got a YouTube website, YouTube page. If you can easily find it, you just type in Rob Buckle, which is Buckle, crop circles, and that will throw up my page. There's a few lectures that I've done on there, a few of them going back 2 or 3 years, but that will give you the full background to how I got into this, and you can see the development of my thinking if you watch those videos in sequence. But the talk that I'm doing tomorrow is more to do with linking it into the next level, which is of looking at human potential.
Very good, thank you very much. I think we've got a question from the audience, which, because it's quite dim in here, I couldn't read, so I'll hand him the mic and we'll see where we go.
Thank you. Yeah, am I right in thinking that there's a few circles that have not been claimed by humans, that, you know, we didn't do them?
Well, there's always stories almost every year that some crop circles can't be explained. On almost every year, there's one or two crop circles that crop up that even circle makers don't know where they came from. And there's unexplained elements to circles. I mean, that's an area that interests me. That there was one crop circle appeared 2 years ago. I know the guy that led the team on that, so I know it was man-made. But they made a circle, and it was in quite a prominent area. And it was the night that we're having a meteor shower. I don't know if you remember that day. There was a big meteor shower, and it was clear skies, and a lot of members of the public were out looking at the skies, and they were making this circle, and they could hear people quite close to them. So they thought, we're going to cut this short, because they thought they were going to get seen and found out, because car headlights kept coming over the field and things like that. So they finished it off quickly. It was like a ring of interlocking circles, and it was meant to have a design in the middle, but they left the design in the middle. And I think it was a few days later, the middle was filled in, and to this day they don't know who or what filled it in. And it was the design that filled in the middle wasn't the design that they had. It was similar, but it was different, but it worked a treat. It made the circle one of the best of that year. But amongst them, normally circle makers know who's responsible for what between them, but they haven't been able to locate who did that, but they did a good job of it, whoever it was. So there's little things like that happen. And there are, as I say, there was, going back to the early days, there's circles that do appear that you can't explain. Normally they're quite simple designs, usually just a plain circle or a variation of a simple circle with elements added to it, but not the very complex ones generally.
That's very good. Thank you very much, Rob. And we'll report back on your talk over the weekend. Well, thanks for being here with us. And so now I thought we'd have a quick chat with Nick, who's, I guess, a ticket buyer. Are you presenting here, or are you, have you come as an attendee?
I've come as an attendee, but that's a part of a much wider research project I'm doing towards a PhD, where I'm looking at the world of alternative knowledge in Britain today. And I have to be very careful how I use words, really. I mean, what the gentleman said earlier from Darren Deosia, that this idea that words are spells. Words are very powerful. You know, what are they? Are they labels? Are they signifiers? Do they make effects? And so when I say alternative knowledge, I've chosen that term very carefully indeed. I suppose I started out looking at, I was looking for the social dimension of so-called conspiracy theorising in Britain. But as any so-called conspiracy theorist will tell you, it's not that simple. And the simple, you know, the state of conspiracy theory studies within the academic world, there's a real tendency to label someone a conspiracy theorist and then flesh out the research by just defining conspiracy theorist, which is completely divorced from social reality. And so really, I'm trying to look at that afresh. And yeah. So that it's very hard to put anything in the show. I'll pass the microphone. Okay.
So, what I mean, a PhD looking into alternative knowledge / conspiracy theory sounds like an interesting idea in itself. But before we get onto what it is, what is it that led you specifically to wanting to do that? And how easy was it to get somebody to sign off on the idea that you could do a PhD on that? For what? Take a couple of years, will it?
Well, I guess I should start a few years ago. So I did my undergraduate degree up at Durham University in theology and religious studies. And I stress there the religious studies part. And when you start studying religion, really you're studying belief. And, you know, I purposefully... I see that as a very broad thing. I was always studying a bit of alternative things. In my undergraduate, I ended up writing my dissertation on the religious vision of Jack Kerouac and the Beat Generation. I had a really supportive supervisor through that, a wonderful academic called Charlotte Hardman. And she was really great through all that. And then anyway, it hit about 2012, I think it was, just before the Olympics. And I think I had my finals coming up, and I had a friend back home who kept suddenly texting me out of the blue about the designs for the Olympic ceremony, Olympic stadium, something about triangles, and something about various symbols on television and certain numbers, and, you know, and all this was completely bizarre to me. I said, you know, this sounds very interesting, mate, but you better wait till I get back home. And so I got back home, and I'd already heard off other friends that he'd been talking a lot about some very strange ideas. And anyway, he came around to mine and he said, Nick, I need to talk to you about something quite important. And so he started this story about the Illuminati and about Egypt, and he kept having to go back further back in time and back to some idea on top of that to make it all make sense. And it was, you know, I was absolutely gobsmacked, but the student of religion in me found it so fascinating. I said, mate, please, I have to write some of this down, if that's all right with you. This is just fascinating. Anyway, so I did that. And then, anyway, some I guess it was only days passed, and we were at the pub together. And another friend, we were at the bar buying a drink, and he said, Nick, you know, you study religions and weird religions and cults and things. Our friend, should we be worried? And I said, you know what, that's a really good question. I don't think so, but that is a really good question. And so I went back to university, and this was at the start of, I was about to do a master's in religion and society was the name, really looking at the sociology, the anthropology of religion and society, how it all fits together. And again, these are just words. It's a very broad area. Academia, they specialise, but that, again, all these specialities are just words. We're all students of life, and it really should be that broad. Anyway, I ended up as an advisor, and I said, well, my friend's been talking about all these things, and actually there's this huge, you know, it's not just him, there's loads of people talking about this Illuminati and these things, and, you know, I think I should do for this massive, I want to look at his belief system, if you like. And she was actually, and she was really supportive. She said, yeah, it sounds really interesting. And so for that, I wrote about my friend and basically wrote a paper on why he isn't mad. And it was quite a successful paper. I liked it. And he, the best thing of all was he read it, and it was based on interviews with him and maybe two other people. There was very, very small number. And he was happy with it. And that was the remarkable. I was worried I'd almost offend him. As the problem with studying religion is it's different from doing religion. I mean, in my more poetic moments, I say that it's almost like you've taken meaning and you've put her under the microscope and you've dissected her and pluck off her wings, so then she can't fly for you. And that's the great danger with studying religion. When you get too involved with studying, you can't live it. But anyway, that was the Masters. And then I got to the end of that, and then I love university. I want to hopefully one day be a lecturer or be involved with research. And so the next thing, I wanted to make this project a bit bigger. And when it was during this time, I had caught wind of a group called Truth Juice, and I was aware, they somewhere, a public group that talks about conspiracy theories. And so I knew there were, I knew now there was this burgeoning whole, there's this whole subcultural world where these things are discussed. And so really it went from there, and I made a proposal to look at, and not just conspiracy theories, but to look at the social world of it, to stop studying these theories as if they're just theories on paper, and we forget there are real people behind them and people who study them. And so that was the angle, and Durham University awarded me funding for that. And then the project started, really.
I think it's an interesting idea that that these conspiracy theories have real people behind them, because of course one of the constant impressions we tend to get from people is that that's one of the actual problems involved in it, is that because we appear to be completely insane or not to have done our homework or whatever, that we're not actually real people, and as a result we get ignored.
But I mean, this is why I think you need to come at things with whole new fresh eyes. There was an incident at university. I say incident, there was a time at university, we were in a room, and I was doing, and it really stuck with me, this, and I was doing a talk on, I was just looking at David Icke's ideas about media rituals and the symbols involved there. And I started talking, and I was talking about David Icke and just briefly explaining to people. There were a lot of internationals there who had never heard of David Icke, so I had to explain. And there were just a lot of sort of smiles and, I don't know, not quite sniggers, but no one was taking this seriously because it was David Icke, people who knew him. And I stopped everyone and I said, can I please just remind everyone that Christianity begins with a virgin birth? And that shut everyone up. We sort of went on from that. And that is the important thing to remember, I think. And, people getting regarded as crazy for talking about certain ideas. Well, a lot of ideas that people think are perfectly normal are completely, absolutely insane. And so, and within anthropology, really, I guess I'm an anthropologist, is that there's a wonderful mantra, which is, to make the strange familiar and the familiar strange. And that's really what I'm trying to do. And I think this the world of alternative knowledge, where all these subjects pull together, which seem at first strange, when you start to study them and spend time looking at them and talking with people, they stop seeming so strange. But all those concepts, and even these, the very label conspiracy theorist, which is so familiar and so concrete, it's a very strange label indeed. And when you unpack any of these, it's very different.
So what has been your conclusion about the conspiracy theories? That they are in fact just conspiracy theories, or that there is something going on? And have you drawn any conclusions as to its connection with old time religion?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I think first I should say that as an anthropologist or a social scientist, it's as if, when we look at religion, what we're not doing is saying, is it true? Is it false? We're just looking at it. We're not trying to answer the question of does God exist or not. we accept religion exists, and then we study that. That's the best way to explain that angle. But, I mean, talking in less abstract terms, a big turning point in the research for me was when I'd heard a lot of people talking about banking and the creation of money and quantitative easing, fractional reserve banking and all these things. And, you know, I kept sort of brushing, this is very interesting, writing down these terms that meant very little to me. And really it was when I then took the time, it was one of my first things I really then studied. You know, and then I understood, it was all like, I understand now, and you began looking at it, and you know, it's all right, it's all true, you know, that money really is made in that way, and the Bank of England is a private bank, and you know, this is conspiracy realism right here. There's no two ways about it. And you then open a mainstream economics textbook that students are learning, that it's all there. You know, it's there plain as day, hidden in plain sight, as you might say. So that was a real turning point for me, I think. And then you get to the point, you know, it depends which conspiracy. You know, and I'm still hesitant to say what I, you know, because it's very hard to say what isn't there. But I mean let's take 9/11 for instance. I mean, the big one. It is the big one. In a way, you know, it's a way that got a lot of people into it. And actually, many years ago, you know, I watched Michael Moore's thing with a friend and with there. And, you know, so I suppose, does that make me a conspiracyist then for thinking about this and for asking certain questions, you know? Anyway, Building 7, that's the point, isn't it? You know, it comes to, for me, there's certain questions that should be posed or can be posed and are very difficult to answer. And as a social scientist, you can't necessarily go beyond that. Or we as humans can't go beyond that. But this, yeah.
I think it is interesting that as we all start looking into these various theories or unorthodox views, I mean, my podcast page, if you try to get to it from a ferry, you can't get to it because it tells you that the internet service provider won't let you go there because of the alternative views. And yeah, indeed, it's interesting, isn't it, in a country of free speech. But it is one of those things where, and the money's one of the places where I go, because we do know that the basic facts as outlined as to how money's created, how interest isn't published, about the banks lending money to the government at interest and all that, we now all know that that's true. And the further you look into the law and various other things, you also find other conspiracy theories are quite obvious, are actually verifiable nowadays. With just without too much research, you can show to yourself that the information you've been, these vicious rumours, are actually pretty accurate. It's exactly where the line lies, isn't it? You know, because you've got an increasing number of people believing the Earth is flat, and that Antarctic doesn't exist. You've got a load of people out there who think that the moon landings didn't happen, and another load of people who think that they do, they did. It seems to me that one of the most important things here is to acknowledge just that there is a debate. That would be a main start, because instead of having conspiracy theorists just having a slide response, at least if people were acknowledging that there was a debate, they'd be keeping a slightly more open mind. Have you had a chance to talk to non-conspiracy theorists in your research?
Well, what do you mean by non-conspiracy theorists?
The people who look at you and say, that's just a conspiracy theory, and switch off. I mean, surely in trying to validate the experiences of the people who are talking about these various things, it's necessary to take on board some consideration of the nature of the people who are actually defining others as conspiracy theorists in the first place.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, one man's conspiracy theorist is another man's sort of factual person, isn't it? I think I've met all sorts of responses, and I understand that, you know, I think back to the money thing, for instance. I remember telling my mum about how money was created and the emotional reaction from it. She burst into tears in a restaurant. I think maybe I was pressing it a bit too much, trying to explain to her this thing. You know, it was the moment I needed to explain it, and it was such an emotional reaction, such a spontaneous reaction. That was quite a telling thing to have one's worldview flipped upside down like that. But I also remember a time when it was when the Iraq war was happening, just beforehand, and we're having this, I was young, and I maybe just struck lucky, but there were no weapons of mass destruction. It was all panic that at any minute Saddam Hussein could blow everyone up. And there was this big argument on the train with some of the guys who were going to school, and that was, to me, I was talking madness to them. But now that's no longer a conspiracy theory. We know those things were fabricated. So it gets complicated like that, I think. Yeah.
It certainly does when we know for sure that things are fabricated, and certainly since 9/11 it's become more and more apparent that more and more things are kind of simply filmed and put on the television as reality. Do you think your studies are going to take us to the point where we can start making some progress at bringing some of the more obvious stuff to light? Do you think you're going to learn anything about why it is that this is happening and whether there's anything we can do about it?
Well, I guess it all depends on whether or not, when I've finished the thesis, whether or not I've shot my future career in the head before it began. I mean, in a way, a lot depends on how some of this is, I guess, received. I think what I want to do, perhaps one of my more modest aims, is at least to provide some really, not just provide, but the people have made up better terms than conspiracy theorists, and I want to call attention to those. I mean, counter-narrative, as opposed to conspiracy theory, is such a more neutral term. But it's a really tough one to say. I mean, which way is it going? I mean, I think I would say that there is a reflexive turn in modern culture. People are becoming almost sociologically self-aware about certain things. The point about the power of the media and the propaganda around and the symbols and the power of advertising. I wonder if we've ever been at a point in history where people are so aware of these outside influences all around acting upon. But whether it's a turning point, I don't know. I really don't. And all I can do with this is really offer a snapshot into a world and say, well, the people I spoke to weren't any more mad than you or I, imaginary reader. But one thing that is important and completely when it comes to writing this up, it adds a whole new tone to it, is some of the things that David Cameron has come out with. When he was talking about to defeat the ideology of ISIL, we must defeat it in all its forms, including non-violent extremism. And he specifically said, there's people who believe that 9/11 is some sort of Jewish plot, and that the events of 7/7 were somehow staged. Now, if that makes everyone I've spoken to at any point during this research a non-violent extremist, then we're dealing with some very, very heavily politicized terms. And if nothing else, I don't know which way the world is going to turn. If it gets more 1984, then at least this research might come out and say, well, this is the truth. I've spent 3 years looking at this movement. They're not, you can't call them non-violent extremists like that. Very dangerous. Words are spells, And if depending on how far you want to take that notion, then calling people non-violent extremists on par with ISIL, with beheadings and blood and the struggle of our generation and everything else, is very, very dangerous terrain. And academics in the academy should be quite afraid of those sort of terms, I think.
Yeah, I think it is. I tend to agree that it's pretty inflammatory language. But again, what he's practicing there is one of the standard basic techniques, isn't it? of kind of divide and rule. And as George Bush said, you're either with us or against us. Which is, horribly simplistic in a world full of black, white, and grey. Here you are at the Conscious Tribal Gathering. What other sort of places have you gone to investigate these people and these ideas? What other strange venues have you found yourself in?
Well, I've been to a couple of the Truth Juice groups in the country. I've been up at New Horizons in the Northwest, and then beyond that, I mean, in terms of events, because I never know how care. I mean, these things are all public. I mean, one thing, it's an aside, but coming into this, I was very worried at first that no one would want to talk to me because they'd all think I was a spy. You know, you would presume as an outsider that everyone would be raging paranoid, especially if someone who turns to them is like, "Oh, hi, I'm trying to research you all. Please tell me things." But the complete opposite was the case, actually. So I think sometimes I'm almost talking myself in my own head, like, you know, don't seem like a spy, but it's all right. It's all right. I've been to Probe was an interesting one. That's a sort of exopolitics conference. The Alternative View, which was more sort of informational, I suppose. And there's been some more spiritual ones. There've been ones along across the spectrum, I think. And that's the real finding, I suppose. I use this on a lot of things, but again, to paraphrase the great late Terry Pratchett on football, the thing about conspiracy theories, the important thing about conspiracy theories is that it's not about conspiracy theory. You know, this idea that it's actually about this spectrum between the informational and there's the spiritual on the other, I think is a really important one. And people almost learning, I don't know, sort of maturing in a real authentic way, I'd say, having looked at other faiths and having, yeah. My friend who originally got me into this research, he has been in the most remarkable spiritual journey in my point of view, and he's abandoned some of the more, I would put it, sort of hysterical or ungrounded beliefs into a, you know, he's really switched on is the term I'd use, I think.
I think that's probably one of my most important conclusions, and it about the conspiracy theory line, and especially about Truth Juice, actually, is that the people that I've encountered coming to listen to these talks and be part of these gatherings over the years, they've all ended up on a spiritual path of some sort or another. It's a bit like the sort of false news and the false history and the false economy and all the other things that we're being inculcated with are actually bringing people to deeper realizations, to realizations beyond just the fakeness of the media, and into, if you like, a more, seeking a more valid and real reason for being here, driving people much further than you'd expect them to go just on the surface.
Yeah. I mean, it quite an interesting reality is that the what was formerly known as the New Age movement, which, you know, was never a movement. It was an academic, really, who I think really drove that vision through, certainly within the study of, well, I suppose we call alternative spiritualities, which itself is loaded anyway. But anyway, it's very interesting that I think what this sort of New Age milieu occupies the same property space, sociologically speaking, as the so-called truth movement. You know, and the sort of exopolitics, looking at extraterrestrial sort of movement, if you like, they all gravitate on the fringes, and have come into quite close accord, really. But yeah, it is quite an interesting one, not something that people would, looking in from the outside, would immediately realise, I don't think.
And do you think there are aliens?
I think there might be.
Yeah, I think that's pretty safe. That is. Oh, thank you very much for that, Nick.
And due to a fatal flaw in the surgery post-production department, that's all that remains of that particular outing. I think we'd worked our way through most of it, though. So it only remains for me to thank, after the fact, my guests for the night, Katie Crayoni and Steve Molyneux and Rob Buckle and a man known as Nick. Thanks to all of you for taking part in the show and for making another unusual broadcast possible, and thanks, of course, to Jay and Barry of the Kitchen Posse for giving over their tent for the evening so that we could all gather and have a chat. And, of course, thanks, as ever, to all of you who are listening on podcast or those who listen by the radio. See you all soon.